Well, welcome back. I appreciate you being here for this next lesson. This morning, in this hour, we're going to be talking about King Herod a little bit. And this one doesn't necessarily deal with geography quite as much, but it deals with a time period. So we want to discuss that. Again, you're being passed out some handouts that'll help you perhaps as we kind of go through this material, give you a little bit of something to do. If you'd like to open your Bibles, I'll be reading this morning from Luke, the first chapter. So Luke chapter 1. I got to tell you, I love Luke. He's somebody that I really, really wish that I could have the opportunity to meet. Perhaps one day I'll have the opportunity to do that. But Luke is the type of person that is well organized. We know that he's was a physician, so he is fairly intelligent. And anytime I get the opportunity to teach a class on the book of Luke or the book of Acts, I really relish that. And the reason is because I like Luke. I like the way he writes. And Luke starts off his lesson, his book here, with some interesting words. And so he starts off in chapter 1 and he says, "Insomuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word that have delivered them to you, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely from some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." And so what Luke is saying here in the first few verses is, I know that others have written the story about Jesus, but you know, once I started learning more about it, I felt it was important for me to do so as well. And I've done the work that I need to do to make sure that what I'm about to tell you is in order and everything is perfectly stated the right way so that you may understand it. And so what that tells me, as someone who's living 2,000 years later, is every single phrase and every single word that Luke uses in his book, in his writing, meant something. He was very efficient in what he said, and what he said he meant. So with that being the foundation, let's keep reading in his book. Verse 5. "In the days of Herod, king of Judea," I'm one phrase in. Do I understand what that phrase meant? Because if you don't understand what that phrase meant, the rest of the chapters in Luke you may not completely understand. Luke based his entire story of Jesus on this phrase. Of all the words he could have used, he chose these words to start his book. "In the days of Herod, king of Judea." And the people at the time understood exactly what he meant by that. Well, here we sit in 2017. We may not completely understand that. And I admit that I don't have a complete understanding of it. But perhaps I can give you some information that help you understand it a little bit more. Because if you understand that one little phrase, that's the whole context of his book. And so that's what we want to do this morning. This is a picture of me taken a few years ago. Much less gray hair, apparently. But anyway, I'm standing on the southern wall of the Temple Mount, and I'll show you some pictures of the Temple Mount here. Well, I just want you to look at that size of that stone I'm standing next to. Herod, when he built the Temple Mount, it's just amazing what he did. We have a misconception in our country of what the word old means. And I'm just as guilty as anyone. You know, we'll drive through downtown Athens and there'll be a sign and it'll say the McGeever house or whatever. And say, built 1885. And I'll tell my kids, oh, that's an old house. That's an old house. Or we may go up to Washington, D.C. and go into the archives and we'll go in there and there's the Constitution. And we'll say, oh, that's old. That's old. well, we don't understand what old is. The city of Jerusalem has 8 gates around the old part of the city. One gate was built 175 years ago, and they call that gate the New Gate. It's the New Gate. You have a total difference of opinion about what old means. We build buildings over here, and we build them expecting them to be gone, maybe even in decades. I mean, how many sports, athletic, professional sports buildings have we seen? The Pontiac Silverdome. I remember when they built that 30 years ago. It's gone now. And we don't build buildings that just last forever. King Herod was a builder. And it is impossible to travel anywhere in the nation, in the country of Israel, without being slapped in the face with Herodian architecture. 2,000 years later, it is still standing and still solid. It's amazing. You know, we have a tendency too to also think that we're smart because we have computers and things like that. You know, we haven't built anything. Only very few things have been built in the last 50 years that compare to a lot of things you'll see built by people millennia ago. It's amazing. We would never get out of the PowerPoint phase. They did things that are just amazing. And this is one of them. But let's talk a little bit about King Herod himself. King Herod lived from 74 to approximately 4 BC. He died in 4 BC. That's a pretty well agreed upon date by historians. This is one of the reasons why you'll hear a lot of people say that Jesus was born in 4 to 6 BC, is because this is the Herod that existed in Matthew, the second chapter, when he asked for the babies in Bethlehem to be slaughtered. And so Jesus was probably born around 4 to 6 BC, but Herod lived between 74 and 4. He reigned from 40 to 4 BC, so he reigned for about 36 years over Judea. He's not Roman. A lot of people don't know that. He's an Idumean. His father was a guy by the name of Antipater, who was an Idumean. His mother was named Cypros, and she was a Nabatean. If you travel between Jericho and Jerusalem, there is actually a hill right there on the left-hand side, and it's still named Cypros. King Herod named that mountain after his mother, and is still named that to this day. You may know the Nabataeans, as they are the people, if you've ever seen pictures of Petra over in the country of Jordan, this is, if you saw Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, the final scene was shot with Indiana Jones and his father and them running in to get the cup, but that was at the treasury building at Petra. Well, Petra was built by the Nabataeans, and so that's where his mother came from that area. He practiced the Jewish faith. And I should put an asterisk on that. He sort of practiced the Jewish faith. King Herod was a politician, no doubt about it. And what he tried to do with the Jewish faith was mostly to gain the favor of the Jews. And that explains a lot of the things he did, especially in and around Jerusalem as well. But this was kind of a double-edged sword, because he was trying to gain favor of the Jews by practicing their same religion, but because he didn't do it exactly the way they said it should be done, they kind of resented him for that also. And of course, we know he just had an extremely brutal reign. The story that we read in Matthew, the second chapter, of him slaughtering innocent children because he was worried that this, infant was going to dethrone him. That's the kind of man he was. He, at different times in his life, he had a wife or two and a couple of kids executed, because he was scared that they were going to dethrone him as well. This guy was just, he was not a nice guy. I mean, there's no way of putting that any more clear. So what I want to do for just a second is talk about the Herodian dynasty. On the back side of that sheet that I hand you, you already have this chart. And I want to walk through this chart. And let me just tell you, there's not going to be a quiz or anything over this. But I want to walk through this chart, and then I've got a couple points I want to make about it, and hopefully you'll understand why I took the time to go through this when we get to the end. But up here at the very top, what you have is King Herod. And when you're the king in the Roman Empire, you can basically do whatever you want to do. And King Herod had a number of wives. We're not exactly sure how many, but he had at least 10 or 12. And in fact, one of them was a cousin, and another one was possibly a niece. This guy just kind of did whatever he wanted to do. And when you have lots of wives, you're going to have what? Lots of kids. That's exactly right. You're going to have lots of kids. And he did. What's listed up here is just a few of his kids. Just a few of them, but the ones that I wanted to point out this morning. After King Herod died in 4 BC, the area that he reigned was divided between three of his children. It was divided between... Herod Philip I over here on the right, and he ruled the area northeast of the Sea of Galilee, up in that area. Then the second one is Herod Archelaus, right here. Herod Archelaus is mentioned in the Bible. If you remember when Jesus and his family went to Egypt when he was really young, they decided to come back to the land, and they were going to come back to Judea. But when they got there, Herod Archelaus was reigning, and Herod Archelaus was very brutal, just like his father. And so they decided to bypass Judea and go up to Galilee. And that's where they lived, up in Nazareth. And the third here is Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas reigned in the area of Galilee, in the area of Perea, just to the east of the Jordan River. Herod Antipas is mentioned a number of times in Scripture. This is the gentleman, I'll talk about this in just a second, this is the gentleman who had John the Baptist beheaded. This is the man who, when asked about him, Jesus called him, you know, go tell that fox. This is Herod Antipas. During the trials of Jesus, Jesus was arrested. He was taken before Annas and Caiaphas. Then he was taken before the Sanhedrin. Then he was taken to Pilate. And Pilate, learning that Jesus was a Galilean, sent him over to Herod. This would have been Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was the ruler of Galilee. Sent him over to Herod Antipas. And of course, when he got over there, Jesus didn't say very much to him, because Jesus knew he would not get a fair trial for Herod Antipas. For one reason, Herod Antipas had already killed his cousin John the Baptist. And so he knew this was not going to go well. But Herod Antipas is mentioned a number of times in Scripture as well. There was another son named Aristobulus who had some kids as well. You'll notice one of those child is Herod Agrippa I. This is the gentleman that we read about in Acts, the 12th chapter. Remember, he was in Caesarea, and he received the praise of the men, and accepting that, and because of his ego, basically, God struck him, and the Bible says it struck him with worms. This event is actually recorded by Josephus. Josephus tells us that he actually died 2 or 3 days later from a stomach ailment. Now, I don't think those two conflict each other. Now, Josephus, you have to remember, is not an inspired writer, so you have to take everything he says with a grain of salt. However, he's a respected historian. The Bible doesn't say exactly when Herod Agrippa I died, so it could have been a couple of days later. But anyway, that event happened there in Caesarea. That was Herod Agrippa I. He had a sister, Herodias, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Herod Agrippa I had some kids as well. You'll see Bernice over there to the left, Herod Agrippa II, and Drusilla. Now, Herod Agrippa II was one of the people that Paul testified in front of at Caesarea. And of course, his sister Bernice was there as well. Historians say that because Herod Agrippa II and Bernice were never seen, rarely seen apart from each other, that their relationship may have been more than brother and sister. We'll just leave that right there. This is an interesting family. And you have another sister named Drusilla, and she was married to a guy named Felix. And of course, we know about Felix from the book of Acts as well. I don't understand Felix. He's married in the wrong family. I don't know how he got mixed up in this. Let's go back up to Herodias. Herodias actually was married to... Are you ready for this? This would have been her half-uncle, Herod Philip I. And so she was married to him, but of course then she had an affair with Oh, and that marriage produced a daughter, Salome, that we have here. And then, of course, Herodias had an affair with Herod Antipas. And it was this affair that John the Baptist condemned. That's why he was thrown in jail. And, of course, later he lost his life. He was beheaded. But it was because of this relationship here that he spoke out against. Now, these family reunions had to be awkward for this family. I show you this, and we go through all this for two reasons. One is, and I say this too, we live in a time, and this isn't a Republican or Democrat thing, we live in the time of the last 20, 30 years in which we can look at our government, and we can see our government making choices on some things that just make our skin crawl. And we think, time, this is the worst it's ever been. Look at this. Folks, this isn't the worst it's ever been. This is what it is. And there have been Christians that have lived through much worse times than what we're going through right now. And we'll stick together and we'll survive, just like they did. But you need to be reminded of this in order to give context and appreciate what we do have. And even though we need to do whatever we can to make sure right choices are being made in our government, it's been worse for other Christians. The other reason that... there's another thing. Salome actually ended up marrying her half-uncle as well. As I said, really confusing. There's another reason why I like to show this chart. And that is, see those people in red? I've circled with red. All those people are mentioned specifically in the Bible, in the Gospels and in the book of Acts. And we have the tendency, I know I do too, we have the tendency just to read through those books, and if we come to the word Herod, we just gloss right over it. And we never think about which Herod this is, or how this Herod relates to another Herod, or how this Herod lived in this time and another Herod lived in this time. We don't think about that. But I think understanding this chart helps you appreciate some of those stories a little bit more. Why was Jesus so upset with Herod Antipas? Why did he react the way he did when he was sent over there? Well, it was because Jesus had a history with Herod Antipas. He hadn't met him before, but he had a history with him because of what he had done. And so these people in red are specifically mentioned in the Bible. And so I think at least having a fundamental understanding of this chart is important. And so that's why I tell you this. But anyway, but that's the family of King Herod. So let's talk about King Herod specifically a little bit. I mentioned that King Herod was a builder. And it is amazing the things that he has built. I mean, here's just a brief list. He built a palace in Jerusalem. He built a palace in Caesarea. He built a palace in Jericho. Small tangent. Okay, take what we learned in the last lesson. Let's think here. What is a reason why he would want to build a palace in Jericho as opposed to Jerusalem? It's only 10 miles, 12 miles difference. Weather. That's it. Wintertime comes. It's 45 degrees up in Jerusalem, 70 degrees. In Jericho. He had a winter palace in Jericho. He had a palace at a place called Manturus. By the way, this is the traditional site of where Herod Antipas was and where John the Baptist was being held and where he was killed, was at Manturus. He had a palace at Masada. We'll talk about Masada in just a minute. He built the temple and the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. We'll talk about that. He had a temple at Banias, which is Caesarea Philippi. He had a temple up there. He had another temple in Caesarea. These temples were temples dedicated to Caesar Augustus. He had a temple in Banias for him, had one in Caesarea. He also had another temple in Samaria. He had other temples and other things in Caesarea Philippi up there as well. He had a huge harbor in Caesarea. Maritima, Caesarea on the coast. We'll talk about that. And then he built his burial place just south of Bethlehem. And we'll talk about that. Now, this, he built many, many, many other things. But this is just off the top. And all of these places are still there today. You can go see them. It's amazing the things that he built. Remember, he only reigned for 36 years. Nearly his entire reign was building things. And it's just amazing what he did. So let's look specifically at some of these places. Let's look at Caesarea Maritima. In our Bibles, this is simply called Caesarea. When you go over there, it's called Caesarea Maritima because maritime, the water, because this sits on the Mediterranean coast, and it differentiates it from Caesarea Philippi, which of course is inland. This is a video, a flyover, going from south to north. The Mediterranean Sea is on the left. And so what you see here is what's left of Caesarea Maritima. You see this theater here. All Roman cities had a theater. This area right through here is the palace, what's left of the palace of King Herod. When you're the king, you can have the best property that you have. And he had the best property for his palace. What you see along through here is the hippodrome. Nearly all Roman cities had a hippodrome. The Greek word for hippo is horse. And so this is where the horse races and other entertainment and things like that took place. You'll see all kind of ruins and activity here. There's actually ruins underneath here, but they have events here. And so they use a lot of this for parking. But there's a lot of ruins underneath the parking lot as well. What we're coming up on is the area of the harbor. There was two harbors. There was an inner harbor, which was right here, this little grassy area, and an outer harbor, which came way out into the water right here. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But this is coming up to the northern part of Caesarea. And in fact, you'll see a little bit of the Roman aqueduct that brought water into the city up there toward the top. But this is the area of Caesarea. This is the city that King Herod built. Now, during the first century, this was the Roman administrative capital. A lot of times we think that the capital was Jerusalem. Well, that was kind of the capital for the Jewish, especially their religious activities. But for the Romans, the capital was, their headquarters was here at Caesarea. And so that's why they were here. This is a picture inside this theater. This theater, the seats have been replaced over the centuries, but the whole infrastructure in the building itself was originally built by King Herod in the first century. So this is 2,000 years old. It's a beautiful theater, overlooks the Mediterranean Sea. They never did anything halfway, King Herod didn't. This is what remains of his palace. As I said, when you're the king, you can have the best property. And his property was right on the Mediterranean Sea. He had a two-story palace here. And if you remember that Paul, once he was arrested in Jerusalem, he was taken to Caesarea and was held in the praetorium. The word praetorium originally meant a tent for a Roman commander when he's out at war. This is where the commander would stay. But the word kind of changed meanings during the time, and it really meant to mean a palace or a headquarters of some sort. And so this is what remains of the palace of King Herod, of the praetorium. So Paul, when he was arrested in Jerusalem, taken to Caesarea, and he was held inside this building. When you're the king, you can do whatever you want. King Herod had a freshwater swimming pool in his house that was right out there in the water. And so, obviously, a beautiful thing to see. Because of the waves and everything, it's slowly deteriorating. But he had a freshwater swimming pool in his palace. Adjacent to the palace, and I realize this isn't a great picture, but adjacent to the palace, there was an area that's been uncovered. That was an area where people could come and talk to the king. This is where he would talk to the people if they need to meet with him about something. Therefore, if you think about the book of Acts, this is the probable location of where Paul testified in front of Herod Agrippa II, spoke to Felix and to Festus. This is where he said, "I appeal to Rome." And, of course, then he was taken later down to the harbor where he was then put on a ship and taken to Rome. This is inside the Hippodrome. This place could have held 50,000 people. Huge, huge, huge area. And one of the things that you pick up on, one of the reasons why I love traveling over there is that you learn these little nuances that the Bible doesn't tell you about. For instance, the end of this hippodrome, you may have seen it on the video, is right up against the Praetorium. And you know that Paul was held in the Praetorium. And it's easy for us to say, well, he was held, but he was held in the palace, so it wasn't too bad. Well, yeah, but he was held there. And you think he sat in that palace and he could hear the people just 50 feet away as they're having fun at the events that were going on in the hippodrome? I'm sure he did. I'm sure he heard that, knowing that he would not be able to go out there and join them, even though he was a Roman citizen. This is a piece, one of the interpretive signs that is there that talks about the harbor. The harbor at Caesarea, and I think Joe has probably told those of you who worship here, he's probably shown you pictures of a lot of these, and so if you'll just bear with me a little bit, but this harbor was the second biggest harbor in the world. You know how if you want to go anywhere around the world, you have to fly through Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta? If you lived in this part of the world during that time, you didn't go anywhere without going through Caesarea. Caesarea had a huge harbor. They had an inner harbor right here, and what you would do is you'd get on a small boat and go out here and get on a larger boat, which then you would take across the Mediterranean Sea. They built this way out into the water. You can think about the engineering that took place. They had to build forms down into the water, pull all the water out there. They built a concrete-type substance, poured it in there, let it harden. Then they went to the next one. They did it all the way around. It took years and years and years. If you'll notice, the opening here faced to the north. That's the reason is because the currents in that area go from south to north. If you had put the door on the other side, the harbor would have been continually filling up with water all the time. These people, we don't give these guys enough credit for how smart they really were. They were just amazing. This is part of the inner harbor here. This is the you can see here. You can see some people walking right here. People would have walked right down through here, and then they would have gone down these steps and gotten on a little boat. And you'll see the grass there. What's happened over the years is that silt has kind of filled in this area. And actually, I think this is kind of a good thing because it now has protected this. The water's not continually beating up on this, so it's not deteriorating. And most of the time when I visit there, I usually see families sitting out there with picnic lunches. This is a national park, and so you'll see families sitting out there. But this is a close-up of those steps. And if you can kind of just imagine Paul, after he's been arrested, he would have come down these steps, gotten into a small boat, and then gone off and gotten into the larger boat. Just north of Caesarea, you have this aqueduct. Caesarea was a huge town, over 100,000 people that lived there. How do you get water to those people? They're right next to the Mediterranean Sea, but that's salt water. Can't drink that. King Herod found a spring at the foot of Mount Carmel, 8 miles away. It's about 300, 400 feet in elevation. He built this aqueduct, 8 miles, from Mount Carmel to bring fresh water into the city. And it brought a lot of water, I mean, enough for 100,000 people. But again, think about that. There's no electricity. There's no pumps. He used gravity to get that water from point A to point B. So over 8 miles, it only dropped a couple hundred feet. Amazing engineering here that took place. Let's talk about Caesarea Philippi. This is a very special place. In fact, Gary and I were talking about this place during the break. This is an interpretive sign there. When they built the city, to be the place where people would come and worship a number of different deities, mostly the god Pan. And they would come here, and there were sanctuaries to Pan, and there were grottos to the god Pan, and they would come here and they would worship here. And this was all built by them. And it was built up, as you can see, up against this, butted up against this flank of Mount Hermon as it comes down here. And a lot of the buildings have fallen, but when you visit there, you can see a lot of the ruins. You can see the foundations of these buildings. And, of course, we associate Matthew, the 16th chapter, with this story. In fact, let's just turn over there real quick. I want to just take just a minute here and look at this. Matthew was a great writer. And Matthew tells us details as well. But he doesn't always tell us all the details. Like, for instance, when he tells us the story of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, through 5, 6, and 7, he doesn't tell us where that took place. He says he went up to a mountain. But when Matthew came to this story, he specifically tells us that it happened in Caesarea Philippi. And so I ask the question, why is that? Why did Matthew feel like he needed to tell us that? Well, then listen to the story here. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he said to his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Think about where they are. They're in a place, they're in a city that is dedicated to the god Pan. And so what Peter is saying in the midst of all this going around, what he's saying is that Jesus, I tell you who you are, you're the Christ. Which is remarkable in and of itself. You're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. Not the dead God that these people here in Caesarea Philippi worship, but the living God. And I think that's exactly why Matthew told us that this event took place there. The people there at that time understood what this city was all about. And it's one of the things that I didn't understand this until I went over there. And Gary actually said the same thing to me. Didn't understand that you go over there. You have to understand a little bit about Caesarea Philippi. And now that's why Matthew mentioned this. But this is a wonderful, wonderful place to go. But Herod, King Herod built all this. What about Samaria? Samaria sits right in the middle of the country. As I said, he built three temples to Caesar Augustus. He built one at Caesarea Maritima. He built another one up at Caesarea Philippi. He built a third one in Samaria. And this is all that remains of that one. These are the steps up to that temple. There was a huge temple here that King Herod built. Interestingly enough, when you visit this place and go around the back side of those steps, what you see are ruins down below. Those are ruins of the palace built by King Omri from the divided kingdom. King Herod built his temple on top of the remains of the palace of King Omri. But that was built here at Caesarea. Let's talk about Masada for a second. Masada is a plateau very close to the Dead Sea. It stands alone. And so, as you can see, there's no way, really good way up it anywhere around here. King Herod used this as a palace, and he built a three-tiered palace on here. Right here on the northern side, you can see the three tiers of that, of where his palace was. Beautiful, beautiful palace. I'll show you some more pictures here in just a minute. But this is where he lived for part of the time. This area only gets about 4 inches of rain per year, but he had built a cistern and an aqueduct system into this plateau that captured every single raindrop that fell on it, and that water would be able enough to last them throughout the entire year. It's just amazing what they built. You'll notice up on the right-hand side here, there is a ramp. This is on the western side, there's a ramp. Some of you may know the story, but after the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, about 1,000 Jewish zealots retreated and went up to the top of Masada. And they lived up there for 3 years while the Roman army was down on the ground trying to figure out how to get up there. And over that 3 years, the Roman army built a ramp. And that's that ramp that you see. I should be pointing this way. I'm looking at that screen. Built that ramp right there. And of course, the next morning they barricaded in, they went through, and when they got in there, they found that everybody inside had committed suicide. Those Jewish people would rather have committed suicide than become Roman slaves. And so that's what that ramp there is. But this was a beautiful, beautiful palace that King Herod built here. The way you got up to it in the first entry was to go up this path. It's called the Snake Path. I have walked up it, and I've done a good bit of hiking in the Smokies, but I wasn't actually ready for this hike. It's a little over a mile, but you gain about 1,200 feet in elevation, and the last quarter mile is straight up. I mean, it's difficult. And of course, there is not one tree. You're totally exposed to the elements the whole time. You're below sea level. This is the lowest trail on the face of the planet. I told somebody that if I can hike up Everest, I will hike the lowest and the highest. I don't think I'll get the second part of that in. But you hike up there nowadays, you can take the 3-minute cable car up to the top. It's much, much nicer. But you get up to the top, and this is the view, beautiful view. This is looking across the Dead Sea. What you see over there are the mountains of what we think of the mountains of Moab. This is where the Moabites lived during the time of the Bible. Looking north, this is looking up the Dead Sea is there over there on the right. And I'll show you something really. See that little piece of greenery right there? That little piece of greenery is En Gedi. It's En Gedi. Why did David run to En Gedi when Saul was chasing him in this area? There was water there. And you can actually see it on this picture. But this would have been the view looking out of King Herod's palace there to the north. As I said, mosaic floors. This guy knew how to build and how to do things. This mosaic floors go all the way back to the first century there at Masada. And Masada is kind of an interesting place, and you may think it's not necessarily a biblical place, but it possibly could be. I'll use the word possibly. When King David was down in this area, it said that he a couple times he escaped to a fortress, and Masada is the Hebrew word for fortress. And so it could possibly be that he went to this plateau when he was down here in this area as well. Well, let's talk about Jerusalem for a second. King Herod, obviously this is where many of his things that we recognize where King Herod built. What you're looking at here is the Kidron Valley runs underneath you. We're looking at the southeastern corner of the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount, during the time of Hezekiah, was about a 500 cubit by 500 cubit square. It was expanded a little bit over time, but then King Herod expanded it to huge, 38, 39 acres in size. And he put the temple up there. He built the temple. It would have sat on or very close to the location of where the Dome of the Rock sits. This is it's an incredible, incredible thing that King Herod built. And it's not just enough. This is the view from the Mount of Olives of the same thing. But it's not enough that he just built these things. He wanted things to look nice. This is a close-up of the Western Wall. Sometimes it's referred to as the Wailing Wall. If you talk to people over there like that about that, they don't actually like the word Wailing Wall because the wall itself doesn't wail. The wall just stands there. It's the people that are wailing. But this is at the Western Wall. And what you see there, all those little pieces of paper are prayers. You write down your prayer and you stick it into the wall. And the thinking is that those messages are transmitted directly to God. But the reason I wanted to show this picture was because look at those stones and look at the etching. All those stones, for instance, that are in the Temple Mount and in other buildings that he built, it wasn't just enough to chisel the stone and put it in place. He made them look nice. They all have this etching on them. I mean, it was incredible what he did. This is looking on the southern side of the Temple Mount, and just look at all these layers of stones here. And if you look closely, they've all got this little etching on them all the way up. All the way up. It's tremendous, the work that he did, that we were there. And of course, you know, this was impressive to the disciples as well. Don't you remember Jesus and his disciples walking through Jerusalem? And his disciples said, Lord, look at these buildings and these great stones. I mean, they were impressed with all this as well. And of course, Jesus told them that not one stone would stand upon each other. And that's exactly what happened. In Jerusalem at the Israel Museum, there is a model, a huge model. It's probably 2 or 3 times the size of this auditorium of what Jerusalem looked like during the first century. And I mentioned earlier how much I love teaching Luke and Acts. What I would really love is to teach Luke and Acts, just put everybody on a plane, take them over there and walk around this and teach Luke and Acts. This is the greatest visual aid ever made. And you can kind of see some people there in the background. You get some scope here of how large this is. But what you're looking here is this is what the temple looked like during the time of Jesus. And you can see the temple building itself, the royal stoa over there to the left. And in the area right here, in this colonnade on this side, this would have been where Solomon's porch was located. Many of the first century Christians met right there in Solomon's porch. But this gives you an idea. And as I said, remember what the disciples said? I mean, the temple stood out over the whole city. From anywhere in town, you would be able to see the temple. And it just stood out everywhere. One more place let's look at really quick. The Herodium. The Herodium, you've probably never heard of before, but this is located about 2 miles south of Bethlehem. King Herod built a lot of things. Among the things he built was a mountain. Let me repeat that sentence. King Herod built a mountain. And that mountain still stands. He built it as a place for him to be buried. And he was buried. He died in Jericho, and his body was taken up the hill and down to Bethlehem, and he was buried here at the Herodium. Think about that. As I've done presentations or as I've driven by here, I've said it 100 times. He built a mountain. But I don't know if I could actually fully appreciate that. I mean, that's what this guy did. It's just amazing what he did. And this mountain, as you can see, it can be seen from everywhere. There was a palace on top at one point. There's bathhouses. There's a theater there. There's all kind of things. This is what it looks like as you're driving by it. But he built a mountain. And it's just absolutely incredible, all the things that he did. Let's think about Luke 1 again as we conclude. In the days of King Herod, king of Judea, and I'll paraphrase, God implemented the next part of his plan to save mankind. He chose this time to do that, despite the fact that all the corruption in government, and despite the fact that the Jewish people were, you know, having problems with the Roman oppressors. And despite the fact, and despite everything that King Herod was doing, this was the environment that was going on in the land. And God said, you know what? This is the time to send my son. And he did. And that's the whole context of Luke's gospel. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, with all this going on, this is when Jesus came. And this is when Jesus came and set in motion the plan that, of course, that we know and obey today. In many ways, it was a terrible, terrible time. But you know, in the best way, it was the best time ever because of what happened. And we are all thankful for that.